Hello, bookers. Welcome to What the Book. This is episode 9. Oh my God, we've nearly reached double figures. I feel so proud. I am, of course, international best-selling author Cintra Sullivan. I have with me a phenomenal, our supremely talented horror author, Kay Benning-Callum. Hello, Caleb.
Hey, how you doing tonight, Cintra?
Fantastic. And yourself?
I am always doing 100.
You are like our Energizer bunny. It just keeps going and going. We have our normal our we normally have David Atherton Cooper, our fantasy author, but unfortunately he's a bit MIA at the moment. So it's just Caleb and I today. We're in a double trouble situation. So Lord help us to
Right.
what might happen with this. Okay,
Well,
so
we're gonna find out. Look, we're almost at double digits, so we're gonna be double trouble. It's just the night of doubles right here, the dirty doubles.
I'm so excited. All right, so this week we're going to be discussing our folklore, where we get inspiration from our environment, legends, inspiration from ghost stories, things that pass
Oh,
down
my favorite.
generations. You're definitely your area. Now, of course, I have to start with a definition. Let's clear up the definition of folk tales or folklores. It is a general term that can be included, that can include a wide range of traditional narratives such as myths, legends, fables, and fairy tales. However, a fairy tale is a traditional folklore involving imaginary creatures such as fairies, wizards, elves, trolls, gnomes, goblins, and fire-breathing dragons. Can't forget the dragons. So this is where the definition, I guess, varies between folklore, fairy tale. So some people say they're exactly the same thing. I think that to me, a fairy tale is more of a fantasy scenario to it, or fantasy creatures, where folklore is more of supernatural realism kind of feel. What do you think, Caleb? Would you define it that way?
Well, I think to me, fairy tale too, I think a lot of it has to do in how it is kind of spread. Fairy tales, I think, are, written, locally, of course, as everything is, but they're usually written, at least in my opinion, to have kind of a universal, appeal. Anybody, anywhere can hear a fairy tale and apply it. It's more applied to life. Whereas I feel like folklore, just in its origin and execution, is something that is regionally applied. It makes sense to someone from that area, maybe not everywhere else.
Absolutely. And we were discussing this just before we came on live about stuff that's local to our areas. I'm going to start off the bat with something that I think Caleb and hopefully all of you will utterly love. When I was growing up, okay, it's a long story. No, I'll condense it down into a short version, Caleb. It's okay. I grew up on a farm, right? So kangaroos and koalas and all this sort of stuff was very normal. They're everywhere. Big farm, and to see the big mob of kangaroos in the front yard sunning themselves in the morning was just what happened. It's just what it was. So my father used to terrorize my friends when they came over with stories of drop bears. Now, these were mythical creatures that were very large. And they dropped out of trees, and they had long fangs and bloody jaws, and they were dark furred, and they would skin you alive as they dropped out of the trees, right? So we had a cow that had claw marks right down its rump where a drop bear had fallen, as my dad would tell my friends with their wide eyes going, "Holy shit, we're not walking anywhere." Because there's this cow with these massive big claw marks right down the back of his rump where, the drop bear had fallen. Now, of course, drop bears are koalas. They get drunk on eucalyptus leaves and fall out of trees. So.
Oh, I've heard about that so much. You got to understand something. Over here in the United States, we are so fucking obsessed with all things Australia.
Really?
especially your animals. I mean, we all love your animals because it's like we can't get them anywhere else. I've never seen a kangaroo.
But see,
Not, you know, and it's,
I feel the same
you
way about
know.
squirrel. I want to see a
Oh my God, no, we want your shit so bad. Everything except for the terrifying spiders and fucking snakes. Y'all can hold on to that. But all the cutesy shit, we want it.
The koala is not that cutesy when it's fallen out of the tree because it's drunk, and it just they have big claws, right? And so it just
Right.
grabs onto whatever's there to stop it from falling. And this happened to be this cow's rump, and it got some massive stitches count. It was some pretty interesting damage, and even healed. You could see these big gauge gouges down the back of his. So Dad, of course, being my dad, it is genetic. My weirdness is genetic. Totally ramped it up and used to terrorize my friends to the point where they would not walk up the back paddocks at all. It was
Oh my God, that would have been fun to come over to your place though and just get the shit scared out of me, man.
absolutely all the goannas that would run up your legs. Oh, my dad used to have a lot of fun. He's a terrible person. I love him, but he's a terrible person. Oh goodness. So now that's something local to my area. That is of a folklore is the drop bears. Now, something local to Caleb's area, I see, is the Honey Island Swamp Monster. What can you tell me about
Oh, yeah.
that?
All right. So the Honey Island Swamp is right by New Orleans. So I have grown up very near and dear to that one. A lot of people think of him as kind of our Bigfoot. The Honey Island Swamp Monster is the legend of that guy came about when people found these giant kind of reptilian footprints out there in that swamp. Not unlike the footprints, you know, that have people talked about for Bigfoot. So, but this was more of like a giant, you know, like alligator, you know, crocodile looking footprint. So, and they studied the gait and the spacing between the footprint, and it looked like it was walking upright in some cases, and just far too large to be, you know, to be any kind of species of large reptile, you know, that was indigenous to that area. So people started kind of making up rumors. And of course, you know, you had people saying that they spotted him and that they saw him. And so now they have Honey Island swamp tours that go out all the time, or at least they used to before all of this, on airboats and things like that. So if you want to go out there and get your ass chewed up by mosquitoes while hoping to get a glimpse of the swamp monster, you know, that can all be arranged for you.
Well, you know, I'm thinking I should because you said that you guys love all things Australian, and guess what? I'm Australian, so maybe I should be coming over there, and you guys can all
Yeah, I
laugh
mean,
at me,
absolutely.
and I'll go look out the spot. And it says here that he's over 7 foot tall. I like a tall man. I like a tall man. You know.
He's a big guy, but he, you know, he's cold-blooded, just so you know. So, I mean, I don't know
Well,
if you're looking for a
there's matted gray hair. You know, we could get some Maybelline and stuff, and you never know. Get some
Give him
men
some just give him some just for men, you know, spruce him up a little bit, you know. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, something
We'll
like that.
let him know you're on your way. Maybe he'll pop out for you. Who
Well,
knows?
you know, I could be the Aussie that comes over, finally spots the swamp monster.
Just
Oh, I love
grab his
that.
ass and we'll put him in the fucking zoo and I'll get rich off of him. That's right.
Hey,
We'll just
wee. There's a wee in that. There's no
That's what I said all. I said we'll all get
All
rich off of him.
right. So, talking folklores, now, if we're going to apply it to a writing sense, when I was writing my Halfway House series, now that's set in Huntsville in Canada, in Ontario, Canada. Now, of course, when you're writing a series or a book in a different setting or a different country, research is always your best friend. To the point where I don't research to the point where I'm anally retentive about it. But of course, you want some local landmarks so that somebody who may be from that area can read it and go, "Oh yeah, she knows where she is. All right, I get
Oh,
that."
yeah.
You know. So
Of course.
when I was writing it, it was in the third book. I needed a character whose name was Abigail Tuft. She was a Sasquatch, as you do. Very lovable girl. A little hairy, but you know, she's lovable.
I did not see that coming. Just like Abigail, and she was a Sasquatch.
I just slipping it in there. She's a little hairy girl side, but it's all right. She only goes hairy at certain times. She's normal other times. She's still tall, but she's, you know. Anyway, so I needed her to come from a legend factor. So in Huntsville, there is a place called Fairy Lake, and there is a legend of Fairy Lake, which has a ghost woman who wanders the edges that has been seen apparently by the locals. So I applied the fact that there had been ghost sightings on Fairy Lake, which sits right next to Huntsville, into my story. So incorporating their local folklores into my fictional stories. I think I did it successfully. My readers liked it, so that's got to be a good thing. Do
I
you
mean,
do
that's
that kind of work?
good. Oh yeah. So I'll give you an example, and I don't, whenever I pull inspirations, and I've explained this before, usually the finished product does not look anything like a direct, adaptation from the inspiration. It usually starts this crazy train of thought that arrives somewhere completely different. But out here, there's a suburb of New Orleans called Covington, and growing up, there was this urban legend out there. There's a really rural like road in Covington called Lee Road, and it's about as rustic as you could want to get. It's about 30 miles from the city. It's way out there in the boonies. And there was a rumor that there was a black van that used to drive up and down there at night. And this was back in the 90s when everybody was talking about this. And we called it the Lee Road Black Van. And the legend around it was that it was full of this satanic cult members that would patrol up and down this road looking for unsuspecting people who didn't know they shouldn't be out there late at night. So they would curb people off the road, they'd run them down and kidnap them and all this kind of crazy shit. And when I was a teenager, I was so fucking obsessed with that. I was like, we've got to get out there and look for the damn Lee Road black van. But that's not exactly something I could convince my mom to do. Like, yeah, let's go out there at midnight and goddamn drive up and down the street to maybe get murdered. Yeah, sure, let's do that. And one cool thing is, like, as I got a little bit older, I remember when I got on AOL, so this would have been around probably 2000, maybe 99.
Oh, there we go. There's a blast.
Yeah,
Radio.
good old AOL, America Online. Got on there, and I remember I just looked up profiles from Covington, Louisiana, and I remember I just like randomly like instant messaged people like, hey, I'm looking into that black van y'all got out there on Lee Road. You ever heard of it? And most people were either like no, or they just wouldn't respond. But I remember one night this person just wrote me back out of nowhere, and they were like, you do not want to know about this. Fuck off. And they blocked me.
Oh, really?
So I was like, oh my God, I was so excited. I've never been so happy to get cursed out in my life.
That would have
So I
doubled
did.
my excitement level by tenfold.
Oh yeah. So I did base one of my stories that's in my anthology, Gree Gree and Juju. It is called The Unkillable Kenny Leonard, and it's about this guy that goes out and gets in this big old adventure. And it starts out with him driving down a very dark, kind of rustic road in Louisiana, and being pursued by people in a van. And that inspiration came from the Lee Road Black Van. So yeah, that's kind of a that might fall more into urban legend than folklore, but still, it was something that I have pulled into, for inspiration. And I just love a good creepy fucking small town story
Oh,
anyway. I have just always loved that.
absolutely. Now, I Google Louisiana folklore, and you guys got some creepy shit going on over there. You
We got so
guys
much, so much creepy shit.
got some real creepy shit. Now, who's
I'm only responsible for like 5% of that creepy shit, so.
it's because you got all the Cajun folklore stuff. So you're looking at this, it's just creepy. What is this word? Rouge-a-nous, rouge. I'm gonna try
Oh,
that wrong.
Lugaroo.
Rugaroo.
That is Lugaroo.
which is a wolf of sorts, a body of human head of a wolf.
Now, here's the thing with Lucaroo and all those. Everybody who tells you about it is going to tell you something different, especially when you start getting out there into the Cajun country. That it's really funny. You have to go out to like Lafayette, that kind of area before you really start running into like the, I guess, like the stereotypical Cajuns that you see on TV. You know, the ones like, come on over here, chef, sit down, let me tell you a story now about old
Because
Luke Garuda. Now I'm gonna tell
you do
you.
understand
Yeah, you really.
that is where all of my research is based on, don't you? Is what I see on
Well,
TV. That's
that's so funny. I was actually thinking about talking about something about that. But yes,
it.
so that is, everybody's going to tell you a little bit something different. A lot of people going to tell you that they saw it. You know, and they're going to tell you, and a lot of people going to tell you that you're crazy. But yes, that is the beauty of, I think that's the beautiful thing about folklore in general, is that yes, everybody is going to have their own little kind of take on it, and it's freaking great. But yeah, Loup Garou is a great one. One of my personal favorites is the legend of Marie Laveau, who is the voodoo priestess of New Orleans. Now, she was based on a real person. There was a real Marie Laveau. And if you watch American Horror Story or any of those kind of shows, she's been featured as a character on a couple of seasons.
Dead set
And
in of AHS. Love it.
yep, so you're familiar with Marie Laveau. So
I
yep,
have
she's
heard
a
of her,
totally real person, totally was a voodoo queen, and she totally is buried in the St. Louis Cemetery right here in New Orleans. Tourists do have a tendency to jump the fence and draw like the X's on her tomb. That's supposed to be for luck or something like that. And the big folklore around that is that she put a curse on the city of New Orleans at the time of her death. And the result of that curse is that anyone who tries to leave the city of New Orleans is destined to return. So
Oh.
that's always a fascinating little piece of folklore right there. There's so much of it. I'm so much more versed in like the ghost and haunting side of it than like the monster side of it, I guess, because I kind of write more of the supernatural than the cryptoid style. But I mean, I can talk about any of it.
Now, voodoo fascinates me. That's some creepy shit too. And you guys got it all going on over there. I love it. And you did that accent so well before. I'm just like, I felt like I was listening to that guy off Waterboy. You know, when you sit there
Oh,
and with his pies, his toad pies or frog pies or something, and I'm listening to him going, I got nothing. Oh, nothing. I don't know. Oh, there's the other one. There's another. Oh, the Gator Boys. Is it the Gator Boys or the whatever the hunting one? And there's a guy on there that has to have subtitles because I seriously cannot understand a word he says. But the accents are so strong. It's incredible. So I reckon I could write a story on the half wolf, half human guy. He sounds like a fascinating one to look into. There you go. I might do something like
he's a great guy. You should totally look into that guy. Absolutely. Oh, Loop Crew.
he's human though. He's got a human body. It's literally he just hasn't shaved for a few weeks. That's all. That's all right.
That's right.
I can deal with.
So between him and the wolf monster, or between him and the Honey Island swamp monster, sounds like you're just gonna get him and take them both to the fucking salon.
There you go.
You know, you're gonna dye one of them's hair. You're gonna get the other one a clean shave. You're just gonna make a couple of clean shaven gentlemen out of these monsters. You're gonna cure it
He's
all.
like straight eye for the hairy guy. I've got it going on. It's all
You're gonna clean them up. Clean them up. Tell me about the bunny yip, man. That thing is ugly looking. I looked at a picture of it. What's the bunny yip, man?
Well, it's Bunyip. Bunyip.
Or the bun yip.
Bunyip is.
Tell me about it.
Well, he's a creature that is found more inland Australia, I guess. He's mythical. He comes from the Aboriginal mythology more, lurks around in swamps and billabongs. I love the word billabong. It's a great word.
Oh my God, the word billabong is that, I thought that was a brand of clothes. That's actually a thing.
It is.
The hell's a billabong? What the
Okay, well,
fuck's a billabong? What the fucking
it
billabong?
is a brand of clothing, but it is an actual, it's a small lake, a small creek. So,
Oh.
where you'd I don't know, you get a little creek through and it gets a little wider and you get a little bit of still water. And that's called a billabong. And it's normally shaded by the gum trees and the little roots exposed. And you sit down, you throw your little fishing rod in, you're good to go.
It's like a bog. Okay. All right. Gotcha. And that's where the bunyip lives, out in the billabong.
Well, they're found around the billabongs in the swamps. Now he is well, they'd say that he sounds like a seal. And it's like in the 1850s, I do believe, that he was first seen or witnessed. I'm not quite positive on that. I should probably Google that before I start chucking out dates. But he is oh, now it says here that he's a water spirit primarily, and from the, oh God, I hope I don't get this wrong, because it is our people, the Murundi people of the Murray River. So
I mean, I'm looking at a picture of it, or an artist's rendition of it, and I can't tell where it begins and where it ends. I mean, it's got
he
like,
has like fins and stuff.
there's nothing like this thing right here proves that like if there is a God, he is fucking insane. That is all that proves. This thing's got like one giant eye on the top of his head. Oh. Ooh, man, that thing is freaky looking. Remind me to stay out of the billabong.
I would stay out of the billabongs. It kind of looks like a well, it's like, it's a seal type of animal, I guess, sort of.
They need to seal it up in something. They need to seal it up in a vault.
Well, let's just stay away from the billabongs. You'll be all right. There's no snakes or anything there, so you know.
All right, so here's a cool question for you then as we move towards this. Going very, 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 very micro cosmic urban legends. Was there ever anything in your home or around your home? Now, this is something that maybe only you, maybe just something your family told you was scary, maybe just something between you and your dad, or just something you saw around the house that just scared the piss out of you as a kid. You just didn't want to go near it. Maybe a door to a closet that you know was in there, something like that. Was there anything like that that just used to freak you out in your own home or maybe in your own like yard?
Well, we had,
Because I have.
as I said, we had property. So there was lots of stables up the back with our horses and cattle, et cetera, et cetera. And there was one stable, and a few of them were in various states of disarray as they, you know, the ones that were used, of course, were maintained. And then there was a few up the back that was probably generationally back, a few that were collapsing. And underneath one of them, somebody had built a bunker, which my brother and I had found, and it wasn't like a full, it was something out of a horror movie kind of fucking bunker, I tell you that. Because it didn't have a door per se on the front of it, and you had to sort of go into the stable and turn behind the main door of the stable, and there was a hole, and you and dug down underneath the cement of the stable base. And there was a hole, like you could stand in it primarily. So I'm not quite sure, but I didn't like it. It was dark. I think I only went in there once. I was like, yeah, no, fuck no. So I'm not quite sure
Well,
what to get out.
I'm gonna tell you the one that's scared the piss out of me. And this is something that you can actually look up. These were real
Yeah.
things, and I have no idea where they came from, who made them, or why anybody would ever, in their right mind, want to fucking own one. But if you have your YouTube pulled up near you right now, I would say look up Laughing Head, LAFFUN space head. These were apparently some kind of little novelty toys that you could buy, and they are these disgusting, disturbing, morbid fucking heads that you pull a string and they laugh at you or some shit. And a friend of mine, his dad had one of these when we were kids, hanging up in their fucking living room. And when I was a kid, this thing just freaked the fuck out of me. And
Oh, no, I see that.
yes, and when I
Circa
got older,
1970s.
I looked them up, huh?
Circa 1970s toy, it says. Oh,
Yes, aren't they fucking.
I don't like the look of that head. I don't like the look of
Yeah, they're fucking vile, man. Like, I don't know who the hell would have ever wanted one of these. But oh my God. And then I didn't even know the thing would laugh
I've got to
when
try.
I was a kid. And finally, his.
Let's see if it'll laugh for me. Ready? Wait for it.
Yeah, let's play the video.
Hey guys, this is
Oh,
my new
hang on.
friend. And maybe you're familiar with him.
Let me see if I can get where the laughing part is. Oh, it is a weird looking head.
Isn't it though?
It's got no eyes. Its eyes are shut. Like it.
Maybe it opens them.
I tell you what, it opens it up. I can turn the damn thing off.
Hold on, let me see if I can get one right here. I got a video. Let's see. I'm trying to find one of just the damn head. No talking, just head.
Yeah, that's what we want. Just the laugh.
Oh, the laugh is so creepy. Let me see here. Oh, I think I
Here we
got it.
go.
You
Oh
hear
my
it?
God, his eyes opened. Holy shit.
Yo,
His tongue
anybody
opened.
out there, listen, listeners out there of the podcast, while we're talking about this, if y'all wanna go on YouTube and look up the laughing head, y'all
Tongue's
can
going in his
fucking see
mouth
what freaked me
because
out.
he's laughing and then his eyes open. Oh no, I wouldn't want that on my wall. Where are you
This
supposed to put that? Just on your wall? Like it's on his
you put it
wall.
in the trash. You put it in the garbage, Central. That's the only place for them. Right in the trash they go. But God, that freaked me out so bad as a kid that I remembered it as an adult. And it was a few years ago that I was just like, I think I had to go on Reddit on one of those like tip of my tongue boards. And I was like, when I was a kid, I remember seeing these ugly goddamn things. Can anybody help out? And somebody linked me to it. And I was like, holy shit. But that was something that just absolutely freaked me the hell out as a kid. And I remember I'd go over to his house and the thing, but he always had his dad was really proud of this thing. I don't fucking know why. Maybe he was trying to give us all heart attacks. Either way,
It's a weird ass.
that
I
was
don't like that one. No. All right. We're going to take a break. We're going to go off and meet the most talented and phenomenal author, EJ Dawson. I hope you enjoy it. Caleb and I'll be back in just a flash. See you in a minute, bookers. Hello, bookers. We're here for an author interview on What the Book podcast. Today we are meeting EJ Dawson. She is an Aussie just like me. Yay! I think it's my first. Oh no, Barry was an Aussie too. So, although he was a Brit Aussie, so I'm not sure if that quite counts. But EJ Dawson is an Aussie Aussie. So, up with the Aussie flag today. My co-host is David Atherton Cooper. Hello, David.
Hey, good to see you.
Always a pleasure to have you here. And EJ Dawson, hello, how are you?
I'm great, thanks, and thanks for having me on the show.
You're very welcome. It was a bit of an impromptu invitation. Hey, EJ, want to come on? Yay, okay, let's go.
I was flattered to get the invitation.
I love it when we can just go, let's go, rightio. We're authors, we talk, it's what we do. My first question for you is, what led you to becoming a writer?
I've always written. I've written stories about princesses that didn't need princes since I was a little girl. I wrote a book when I was about 16, that, of course, given Buffy at the time had vampires and was wonderful and the best thing in the world. And I stopped writing seriously on and off for a few years. And then when I turned 30, doctors told me that I might not be able to have kids, and it was a serious enough at the time that I needed to find something to do with my life. So I turned more seriously and professionally towards the one thing that had given me purpose and made me happy, writing. From there, I started working on something brand new, which was the Last Prophecy series.
Fantastic. That's your steampunk series.
Yep, that's the one. So that's quite a big series that was a bit off more than I could chew, which is typical for me. It's a 21 book series with 11 novellas and 10 books. I'm actually
Holy
about.
Crap, are you serious? 21 books?
Yep. So I've actually written 4 books in that series and 7 of the novellas already, but they're big books. They're 120K word books and they're 60K novellas. So they are not small. It's quite a big endeavor, but it has a lot of purpose and personal meaning to me. But the editing is very expensive because I have this great editor I absolutely love, Scott. He's marvelous. But I need the books to actually sell, and it's kind of easy to sell once the series is over. So I've turned to a few other projects in the meantime.
See, it's interesting that you call 60K a novella. See, I wouldn't have 60K theoretically would be to me a novel size, smallish novel size, but still standard novel size. And yet you're saying that's a novella. I suppose compared to the 120K, it is.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And it's got a special, unique setup. So this hasn't been done without purpose. There's a poem that's part of a prophecy about the coming of dark times, as prophecies want to be. And there's a poem that goes with it. And so the stories in the books revolve around individual characters who will occasionally make appearances in the other books. For the most part, they're separate. So the books can actually be read as standalones for the most part. And each of those characters are basically people like you and me who are put in a position where they can change the world potentially for the better. You know, and it's discovering the difference between right and wrong, but in circumstances that make a huge difference. Like, what would you have done if you were there when they discovered that they could make an atomic bomb kind of difference? Whereas the novellas circled around Katerina Salisbury. She's the captain of an airship, and she actually finds the prophecy with the help of a archaeologist. The novellas all pretty much focus on her story throughout all the books, because the things that she does and the things that happen to her directly correlate to the books as well. So she will often appear in them, or events that happen in them will affect her in the novellas.
That's amazing. And you've got to love A Prophecy of Dark Times to bring it all together and a hook to hang everything off. That sounds fantastic.
If you want, I can read the poem for you.
Oh, yeah, if you've got that handy.
I've pretty much memorized it, but it's posted on my wall. But it goes like this. Since capture and taming of fire, cross worlds lit by man's pyre, relics of old will not rust, lost in time, crowned in dust. In man's hands certain fate, gripped by limitless hate. Frozen tears start to thaw, sleepers awaken from before. Shadows slink in puppet's guise, striking the sinless led by the wise. Words of God's cross night sky struck black the earth, letting virtue die. Let loose the howling beast, hear its lies upon devouring its feast. Twisting thoughts through the fear, singing to silence not to hear. See echoes of a soul unknown, holding deceit in the heart of its throne. Turning the key on misguided fool, exhausting the dead endless pool. Feel the lingering touch of blight, stealing from seer sacred light. By the fists of many, a world will quake, time for world's end to awake. Brought together by fate, led by a lie, till the end, where darkness comes to die.
Wow.
That's pretty fucking cool. I love it.
Thanks very much. It's a story that's really close to my home, and it's about the world wars and how awful that they were, and that we, you know, times like this when everything is really chaotic and really, really bad. And sometimes it's just the decision of a few who are in the right place at the right time to decide what the right thing is to do. And that's not always clear. And that's what the stories are about.
That just sounds like an amazing series to read. I really want to read those. Hey, just thinking about all of those, but something we've talked about a little while ago on this podcast, and when we ask people about quite a bit, how do you create or find your characters? So do you develop them consciously, or do they find you as part of what you're writing?
I think it sometimes depends. Echo of the Evercry was a book I'm actually querying at the moment, and that actually came to me in a poem. about basically a young girl who's got a secret magical ability, as they tend to do, but she's shunned in her world. And the story is about this, the whole entire story came to me from this poem that's at the start of the book. But The Last Prophecy got its story because when I decided to start writing professionally, like writing something that I wanted to self-publish, which is why I chose to self-publish, because I knew nobody was going to take a 21 book series seriously. That story actually came about through a few random generators. I wanted to write something fresh and new and different, something I never had before. And that came through to a random generator that began about a airship chase across a desert. And that's actually book 4 or 5 in the series, because when I started writing that book, I realized there was more to this story. And when I plotted it all out and worked out everything that was going on, I had this epic series I really wasn't sure what to do with.
Wow.
So yes, it's absolutely, stuff will come to me in dreams, stuff will just randomly, I'll be listening to a song and I'll get a picture in my head. Sometimes it's much more purposeful. I'll actually have to work out exactly what I want and who's involved, but there's always a spark within me. It doesn't come normally from something else. There's always just something that I build upon that I've thought of myself.
I am floored by 21 book series. I seriously am floored. I thought my first series being 7 books was a lot to take on. The 21, you totally floored me out. When you're building your stories, it's not what's more important, I think, but more what comes first to you. Is it the world that you're trying to create, being a science fiction and steampunk and that kind of genre in your writing? Is the world as a whole more important? Let's just loosely put that word in there, to build on first, or the characters, which one comes through first and hardest?
I think I'd have to actually go character. I'm a lot more of a plot focused person, but I think generally there tends to be a character something that actually sparks it, and then I build on that initial spark into what I think happens around it. So I don't like to classify myself as a single genre writer. I like to write in a range of genres, perhaps overachieve in those ones. So a perfect example is when I find out that I need to put The Last Prophecy on hold because I wasn't going to be able to self-publish it, because it's such a mammoth thing to keep going. I actually dropped everything to write something completely different. So I wrote a gothic noir novel set in 1920s Los Angeles about a woman who could read the veil between life and death. And it was so nice not to have to write The Last Prophecy series. I got that book out in about 25 days. And it was good. It was a nice paranormal romance that got picked up by Literary Wonderlust during a PitMad event.
Massive. That's awesome. I do the same. I like to swap around from genre to genre. Even if I'm doing a long series, I tend to alternate between them just to keep my mind fresh and the stories fresher in my head, as opposed to, I think sometimes if I'm stuck in a series and I'm doing book after book in it, I get trapped. I feel trapped.
Yeah, no, and I think it's important to have those sorts of those outlets and those places where you can put other ideas and other things that you want, because as writers you can go through an exhaustion period. Like I know it happened to me at the end of last year, to my detriment. I decided it was going to be a really good idea, given everything that was going on in my life and all the changes I was making, that I'd write 10 books, and I only decided after half of the year was already gone. But I had realized that if I wanted to achieve my writing goals, that I need to do that. But one of the things that made it easier was having a whole bunch of, like, I was writing these paranormal romances. I was writing these sci-fi action-based stories. I was writing a fantasy about a young girl and coming to terms with her life. And I wrote about one other girl who was just really, really full of rage, having fun to do it, to post on Wattpad. So, yeah, I absolutely agree with you, and I absolutely think you need to vary what you kind of work on so that you can stay refreshed and you can keep it interesting and like as you keep going with other books.
It also helps if you get blocked on one for some reason. I don't know if you've ever suffered the writer's block, but having several different threads means stuck on one, move to another, and then by the time you come back to the first one, it's running again?
I'm going to make a small confession that I don't like to advertise. I don't get writer's block. Normally I can make myself sit down and write through it. And I have tips and tricks and tools I have on my website to get through it. It was one of the things I actually evolved from doing NaNoWriMo for the last 5 years, because you've got to stay with the story in NaNoWriMo. So I kind of developed these tools that help me get through it. Like, you know how you get to this point with a story, and I like to think that there is a difference between writer's block, which is not knowing what happens next, and writer's exhaustion, which is I'm tired of writing this story. And I think a lot of people get those two things really confused, because there's a difference between those two things, not actually knowing what's going to happen next and saying I need to just leave this alone for a little while. And I like to think of that as writer's exhaustion. You kind of know where the story is going. What you can't do is sit down and work on it anymore. Whereas writer's block is going, oh, my God, I've painted them in a corner and I don't know how to get them out. And the one trick that I use is I either use my partner as a sounding board, who's incredibly irritating. I love him, but he's incredibly irritating because he will do things like we sat down to watch The Usual Suspects, and I don't know if you know the film.
Know it well.
Yeah, so Kaiser Soze is the bad guy, and my husband turned around and pointed at the actor in question and went, he did it. We were 10 minutes into the film. So I tell my partner the plot, and he can say to me, no, that's not going to work, and this is why. He's very good at that. But the other thing that I do if I'm not happy with it is I treat it from a role-playing perspective. So I do a lot of role-playing in my spare time, not so much Dungeons & Dragons, a lot of the other games like Cthulhu and All Flesh Must Be Eaten and things like that. But basically what you do is that has taught me to be really, really good at adapting to characters sometimes going off the plot or off tangent. Because quite often you will have that with people. Characters you can control, people you can't. So sometimes the players do things I didn't expect. And what I learned very quickly to do from that was if they did something that I wasn't expecting, I'd say, well, these are the options for them for what will happen next. And I'm like, I would try to narrow it down to just a couple, so just two. And then I would roll a dice. And that dice was usually a D100. And the closer to either parameter, so 0 being no and 100 being yes, the closer the number that I rolled was to each one of those, how strong that decision ended up being. So if you've got a party that need to rescue someone from a castle, do they boldly go in the front gate and see how it goes, or do they sneak into the back kitchen? So normally you can really devolve down what character decisions need to be made to stay on the plot for one of those two things, and then you use a die roll to figure it out.
Fantastic technique. I love that way of doing it. I quite often will have characters. I don't suffer writer's block generally. I will suffer from crossroads where I'm sitting in the crossroads and they're like, well, what do we do? I'm like, well, fuck, you're supposed to be doing this. What the hell? I don't know what you're doing. You tell me what you want to do and I'll go where you want me to go, you know? And then I have a critique partner who we both claim to loathe each other, but honestly, I couldn't do it without her. And you know, I could say to her, here's the crossroads. They want to do this, and I think they should do this. And she goes, well, that's not going to fucking work, so you've got to go this way. Oh, okay, that seems logical. Let's go. And as soon as it's sort of that decision's made, the story goes again really quickly. But writer's block, I agree, is a very different thing and hard for people to work through.
So your crit partner is your dice.
Yeah, pretty much. Like, well, my critique partner for an initial plotting phase is definitely my husband when I can't get the dice to kind of work for me. I use the dice a lot when I'm writing to a deadline. So I will try to write certain books within certain time frames, particularly if I've got a story that's really exciting, like my muse is a complete nutter bitch. And she will occasionally dump something on me, like she dumped something on me early this morning that I've written down and I know is going to be the next book I work on. And it will be sitting there like a toad in the back of my mind, like croaking away incessantly, saying to me, write me, write me, write me, write me. And when I have those sorts of moments, I tend to just go with it, because what comes out of it is generally something I'm pretty proud of. It tends to be quite, I get quite taken away with it. And I think that's really important that you get taken away with what you're writing, because it means that if you can keep it upbeat and fresh and interesting and engaging, you are going to find that a lot of readers find it like that too. And that might just be my style or who I am, but I'm absolutely a pantser, not a plotter. So as soon as I get that idea, I'm like a bat out of hell, just heading towards the end.
You just answered the last question. Are you a plotter or a pantser?
Absolute pantser. Absolute pantser.
Hey, question though, can you write more than one at a time?
Absolutely. If you'd like to know, at the moment I've been editing Queen of Spades, the final book, just doing a very, very last polish on it, but I'm actually already drafting together the first lines for Queen of Hearts, which is the next trilogy that comes after that, which is a whole bunch of different characters, though the other characters are in it at some stages. I'm also working on a young adult, I guess you'd call it psychic powers book, called Butterfly's Kiss. I'm also working on the next one in the, so I wrote a book called One with Rage. I'm now writing another book called One with Hate. I'm also working on a book called An Absent Tale, and the plot's proving rather difficult, but that's similar sort of book to Behind the Veil, which is that gothic noir. So I have a few different things on the go at the moment, and that's true at any particular time, which means I can flick over to any one of them when I feel like it. So if I get the impetus suddenly to just write on one specific book, I can just go and do that. How I do it is I usually have a particular soundtrack for every book I write. So I just put on that soundtrack, reread what I've written in the last couple of pages, and then get back into the flow of it.
Wow. That's awesome. So okay, you're writing, jumping between storylines. Maybe you get really into the moment, you write something you really care about. How do you handle writing scenes where you get emotionally involved, or you're emotionally connected to what's going on? How do you handle those?
I'll be honest, I usually just cry. I think that a lot of the time it can depend. Sometimes it'll be absolutely clear that I'm writing something for an emotional intent. There is a scene in the upcoming Queen of Spades book where Isla discovers something's being taken from her, and it's really personal to me. It was something that happened in a similar sort of circumstance. And I find that really, really hard. But while I find it hard, I cried when I wrote it, and then I still find it hard at the time or even talking about it. So I tend to just cry, because it's a great emotional release. Sometimes it's a little different, though. I think that a lot of times we write cathartically, but we don't always identify the things that we're saying and doing have other meanings or layered effects. So when I wrote Echo of the Evercry, there was a lot of nuances in it about myself as a teenager and who I wanted to be and where I thought I'd be when I grew up, and also the kind of pressure and expectation that was placed on me by my parents, and particularly my mother, because the main character has an interesting relationship with her mother. She's actually on a quest to save her, but she's also has all these, her mother is the best swordswoman in the order that she's in, and the main character doesn't, it's not that she can't fight, she hates violence and she loathes killing. And that's not the relationship between me and my mother, but it's a similar sort of pressure. And I didn't realize how much that's actually portrayed in the book until I actually won a developmental edit off Meg Trust, who is a wonderful person and a wonderful editor. And we actually went through a lot of those character nuances, and she helped me discover so much more of myself was in the story than I'd ever realized. So I think sometimes you do it unconsciously as well.
Absolutely. I definitely echo some of that, and I'll reread some things I've written a while later on and realize that there's something going on there that I hadn't consciously put into that scene, or other people read it and tell me that. Yeah, no, that's I hear you.
Or somebody pisses me off and I consciously write them in and kill them off. Oh, I didn't say that out loud.
You're going to absolutely love the opening for my tribute for Queen of Spades. So I'll have to give you that one because I think you'll get a chuckle out of it.
Awesome. I'm completely in awe of you, EJ Dawson. Holy crap, woman. You have got so much on the go right now. I totally get the playlist. I do that myself. Certain music will bring certain characters and certain voices through, and they only respond to that music. But damned if I can write more than one at a time. It's like if I start to write a different one, the characters go, oh, I see how it is. You don't want to talk to me? I'm not good enough for you? Fine. I'll just stop. And then it's gone. So I have to stay with that same book from start to finish. And it has to be from first line to last line. I cannot go out of order. I don't know. I'm just anally retentive, I do believe. Maybe. I don't know. But anyway, I'm totally in awe of your abilities.
Thank you. I definitely write series in orders. I couldn't write other parts of the series before or after because this ends up being so many changes. So the Queen of Spades series is actually the Queen series. So the trilogy will be out all this year, and it finishes on a final note for the characters in it, like they get the happily ever after. But the other series that come after still have have some of the same characters and stuff in them, but I definitely have to write them in order because of what happens, but also because I change it. So I'll go out with a rough idea of what I plan to do, and quite often that will change. So when I started writing Queen of Spades, I wrote the Queen of Spades book, and I knew exactly what was going to happen in that book without sort of plotting it. I had just had this idea in my head of where I thought it would end up. And then I started writing book two, and I wrote book two, and I'd written it all in first person, and then I put the series down for a little while. And then when I came back to the series, I realized that book two was going to be better served as book three, and then came and wrote a completely different story for book two. So, yes, I absolutely agree with you. You have to write the series in order.
It's the only way it works in my head. I don't know. I can't do it. Yeah. I admire the people who can do it, you know. And I say this all the time. I think I've said it on every single podcast and I tweet about it a lot, that, you know, the writing community as a whole is one of the most beautiful places because we all achieve the same thing at the end. And yet our journeys to get there is so varied and vibrant and unique. And I love every single different way we do things.
Mm, and I think it also opens a lot of possibility, a lot of differences. Like I know that I originally felt bad thinking, what kind of a trash fire have I written in 25 days? And it was really nice to see they actually get picked up by I actually got two offers to publish, but I picked Literary Wanderlust because I had a better rapport with the editor. And I'm really, really glad I've done that because now I talk to the publisher quite a lot and they're really supportive. They're helping promote Queen of Spades, even though I've decided to do it myself. And I've decided to do it myself because Queen of Spades has a lot of characters that all connect together. It was part of a trilogy, so it was going to be a bigger book, but then they wanted to wait a couple of years to get it all written and get it all sorted and whatnot, and I knew that I was more ready than that. But they're supporting the release of that of the series as well, so they're really wonderful people to work with.
That's fantastic. We're gonna have to run this up. I could talk to you for hours, couldn't we, David? We could just keep this going for hours and hours.
Oh, we have to stop.
Yeah, no. We have to. Look, honestly, we could just open up a bottle of bees and just keep going. Okay, now, last piece, because you've already answered my plotter and pantser question, which is normally my last one. But okay, brand new author comes to you, wants to know one piece of advice. What do you give them?
Trust your gut. And I know that seems like a really odd thing to say, but given all the different avenues towards publishing and given all the different things that anyone could ever write about, the thing that matters most is what you spend the time on the story itself. So it doesn't matter what it's about. It doesn't actually matter who publishes it. And it doesn't matter what ends up happening to that story. What matters is that you trust your gut. And I have learned to rely on it to make the right decisions. And then so many times in such an uncertain industry, and especially in such uncertain times, I have learned that when I get a feeling or when I get an uncertainty, to go with what my gut is telling me. So it doesn't matter what story I'm working on. It doesn't matter who I'm publishing with, and it doesn't matter where that story ends up. I have to rely on my gut and my instinct to tell me. And, you know, it's not always a good thing. Like, I trusted my gut when I signed up with Literary Wonderlust, and it was the best thing I ever did. But I also trusted my gut when it told me the Echo of the Evercry wasn't going to find the right agent, it wasn't the right environment, and while I'd queried a lot of agents, some of which I still haven't heard from, I have since filed that book away. That book is now on the shelf because now is not the right time for that book. And I think that that's one of the best but hardest lessons to learn, because you want the best for your books. You want your books to do really well. You want to be the next J.K. Rowling or George R. Martin or whatever it happens to be, and the reality is that it's not like that. And I think that the happiest that you can be is in writing things that you love to write rather than writing to the market, but also to trust your gut on where those stories are going to end up and how they get there. So I have a book on Wattpad, I'm self-publishing, I'm with an indie press, and I'm still trying to query with traditional presses. And I think that you have to, when you have your story in your hands, there's a great divide in the writing community about what the right path is. And I don't think anyone should define that except you.
Brilliant advice. I absolutely love it. And every different avenue to get your book out there is as valid as any other one. It's no longer what it was years ago, where it only had to be mainstream and only had to do that. The way the world works now, the avenues are so varied that I completely agree. Trust your instincts and hope for the best and do your best. Thank you, EJ Dawson, for being with us this afternoon. I have had an absolute joy speaking to you. Where can our listeners find you?
So I'm predominantly on Twitter. It is the writer's platform, and that's at EJ Dawson Author. You can also find my blogs, writing advice, marketing advice, basically where I fucked up and how you cannot do it on my website. I said it. There you go. I swore. You can find that at ejdawson.com. I'm also on Facebook. And I have a Goodreads page, obviously, as well. And you can hit me up for anything, because I'm more than happy to share what I've learned doing this for the last 6 years. Not just the mistakes I've made, but where it's gone well.
I know I've spent many a Twitter message with you going, oh my God, what am I doing?
Yep. Pretty much.
David, anything you want to say?
I was just going to say that's all brilliant advice, and it sounds like a phenomenal series. So I'm going to go check them out.
Thank you. And thank you for having me on the show. It's been a delight.
Thank you, EJ. Thank you, David. As always, you are the best co-host ever.
It's been a pleasure.
I will see you next time, bookers. Have a good afternoon. Bye.
All right, bookers, welcome the book back from that awesome interview with EJ Dawson. She is just too cool for school, just too phenomenal for this animal. Definitely wonderful interview. And speaking of crazy people, hey, me and Centra are back in action here. Let's do it to it. Centra, how are you?
I'm fabulous. I loved listening to EJ Dawson, loved getting to interview her. She is an inspiration to me personally. And an Aussie. So, yay! Go Aussies!
She is the alpha and omega of this motherfucker.
Yes.
Alrighty.
So, where are we going with this, Caleb? Lead us through.
Well, you know what? We talked about folklore and we talked about urban legends and writing and all this kind of crazy shit. Now, let's kind of flip the script and project a bit. And talk about how we saw other places as kids growing up. I know, as an American growing up in America, Australia is one of those places that it don't matter who the hell you ask over here, it's on every American's bucket list to go visit Australia, to go hang out over there, because the Australian people in the United States have been absolutely goddamn fictionalized to the point of mythological. And one of the points that I was going to bring up is we compare our perceptions of each other. was the Foster's beer commercials. Any of my fellow Generation Xers out there will remember the Foster's Australian for beer commercials growing up. And I remember they just made Australia look like this fucking lawless goddamn paradise of just the most beautiful muscled people. The women could kick your ass. The men were fucking badasses on motorcycles. Everybody ate fucking steak 12 times a goddamn day. You just woke up in the morning, you punched a kangaroo in the face, and you went to fucking work. That's what Foster's made me believe. So let me ask you this. How does that stack up?
Okay, well, we don't, as Australians, we actually don't drink Foster's because it tastes like shit. As far as beer goes, yeah, no. It's strictly for tourists only because none of the locals will drink it in a pink fit.
Do they even sell it over there?
Yeah, you can, but it's really, you have to ask for it. It's certainly not. We drink American beers. I don't drink beer personally. I use it on my hair or on battering my fish. That's it. But
use it on your hair for what?
Yeah, no, beer on your hair. It gives you a luxury shine. I need to use it on the Swamp Monster. And yes. What was the one that I was looking for? The Wolf Boy.
Oh. Yeah, we're going to beer them up real good.
It'll make them shine or silky smooth, I tell you. So we don't actually drink Foster's. And the perception, as you said, that you know both Americans and Australians have been Hollywoodized. To the brink of no longer actually knowing what we are supposed to be. The amount of people who have said to me, you know, something about Steve Irwin or Hogan or, you know, the quintessential poster children that have been advertised or movies regarding Australians. And I'm like, but we don't even talk like we don't talk like Steve Irwin. He, phenomenal man was, but we don't talk like him. He was a character. He played a character, and the whole family at Australia Zoo are all characters playing that, and it's beautiful. I love it, but as a culture, that's not how we talk.
Yeah, we talked about, we had this discussion before. You're saying it's kind of it's a caricature. It's an exaggeration, essentially.
Absolutely. You know, going on about, oh, she's a real beaut. I haven't called anybody a real beaut or a Sheila or I don't know. God.
So Sheila, all right. So is that ever used, look at those Sheilas over there? Is that ever really a thing or is that just more Hollywood bullshit?
You are never going to get laid if you call that. Never going to happen.
Right, looking pretty, Sheila over there. Hey, yeah, not going to work. Gonna get laid.
No, no. And it's funny though because when Americans will come and talk to me, and you get this impression that they expect us to be so outback. My dog's going off. So outback.
Talk about that. There's fucking dogs out there barking.
it's just Thor. He's my baby. It's okay.
Why your dingoes down back there now?
You know, we have indoor toilets. There's no difference anymore to how we live. I don't think there ever was, but we were very Hollywoodized. Through Croc Dundee, I think, especially that movie.
The accent is where I think it is. They just absolutely, over here in the United States, they just go ape shit for the way y'all talk over there.
Somebody said to me the other day, I had a really ocker Aussie accent. And I've gone, I do not have an ocker Aussie accent.
What the hell's an ocker Aussie accent?
Something that he said I was more... not Hugh Jackman because he's more classy Aussie accent. I was more a Paul Hogan than I was Hugh Jackman, because I have a rougher Aussie accent, or an ochre, a more deeper feel to it, I guess. And I'm like, I do not. How dare you? Rude. Because I don't think that, you know, none of us think that we all have accents of our own.
Nobody here. No, nobody. Everybody else has the accent. You know, you're
not me.
Exactly.
So, you know, and I have said on this show before, I'm a complete accent whore, because I love listening to all the different accents of different authors that come on, and your accent's beautiful. And one thing, growing up, looking at America as a country growing up, was that the differences that you have in your accents. Okay, so in Australia, from Western Australia over to Queensland, so that's one side to the other side, there's no difference in the way we talk, whether you're in the Northern Territory or in Melbourne or Sydney or whatever. Some of the slang can be slightly different, but the accent is exactly the same across the board. And same with New Zealand, across the board, same accent. Where in America, whether you're in, say, Detroit or New York, is very different accent to if you're in Louisiana. It's like you're in a whole completely different country.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I go, wow, this is brilliant.
Talking about the fucking Cajuns earlier. Even down here in Louisiana, we have a hard time understanding some of the motherfuckers. So, yeah, I get it.
So that fascinates me, is that one country can have such a vast difference from one end to the other end.
Oh, people who talk in Boston, like the way Boston people talk is fucking hilarious to me. You know, just that, you know, that everything, every R is an H with them. They're like, my name is Mike. I go park my car. It's like, yeah, they don't pronounce R's. Everything is just,
they don't have an R.
No, everything's an H. Go to the pack. Go park your car, Mac. Yeah.
It's like the Kiwis who don't have the I. It's just all U's. So fush and chops. And socks instead of six.
Wait, what now?
I love it.
Wait, say that again.
If you're Kiwi, it's, you can hear them a mile away. That instead of fish and chips, uh-huh, it's fush and
chops. Fush and chops?
Fush and chops. And instead of the letter six, it'll be socks.
Damn.
So you go 4, 5 socks, 7.
Okay, then. I'll have to have me a translator if I ever meet them.
Now we're just going to totally rival up the Kiwis. It's all right. It's a Kiwi-Australian rivalry that goes on for generations. It's fine. We beat them at the cricket and the footy. It's all good. The other thing that I noticed about when I was growing up in and watching America. Now, of course, growing up as Gen Xers, everything that we saw was Hollywood. You know, it was put on our TVs. So I assumed it was very accentuated, and you know, you watched the movies down in Texas, where everything was so huge, everything was massive compared to everywhere else in the world. You know, a simple cheeseburger and chips were suddenly 3 plates worth, or people's cowboy hat. I mean, of course, we're Aussies, and cowboy hats are done out west. But the, you know, the Hollywood version in Texas was these massive big hats and these big holsters that are all, you know, around their waist. And so this is what we grew up, or I grew up watching, thinking, oh, this is America. This is great. I want to go there. Can it take me there?
Well, if you talk to people from Texas these days, they still fucking think every damn thing they do is huge. And my wife is from Texas, so I better be careful that I don't say that too fucking loud. But yeah, the idea of everything's bigger in Texas, that's definitely part of their kind of mentality there. When I was in the Army, my first deployment overseas, my roommate was actually from Texas. He was from San Antonio, and that's a whole special breed of Texan. You will never meet someone, I think, that loves that state more than people from San Antonio. And they have to tell you every fucking time you talk. You could be talking about anything. They will somehow bring up, oh, you know, Texas is the only state in the country that can technically secede from the United States whenever it wants to. And they're so fucking proud of that. It's like the people bring that up all the time, that it's in their constitution, that they can become their own country again whenever they want. And it's just like,
really?
Yes.
Wow.
They love that shit. But even Texas in and of itself, though, is very different, depending on where you go. Some parts of Texas are like that stereotypical, like, I'm rootin' tootin', you know, I love my gun. Yeah, you get that. And then there's also like Austin, Texas, for example, is far more like laid back. It's more of like a college kind of scene. Everybody's kind of, you know, chill. And so it really depends on where. Of course, Texas is like the size of like fucking, I think you can fit the entire UK into goddamn Texas. So, you know, you're going to run into a lot of different kind of regional cultures, you know, depending on where you go in that state.
That's funny, isn't it? Because we get two countries, Australia and America, and theoretically we all speak the same language. We all speak English. I mean, even if we brought into the UK into this and or England specifically, I guess, and, you know, New Zealand and whatever else, and we all speak the same language. We all live in houses. We all, you know, work the same jobs, theoretically speaking. And yet the little idiosyncrasies that each country and in some parts states is just phenomenally different, you know, for all being the same. I don't know. I know. I'm having a little space out moment. Save me, Caleb. Save me.
Well, I'll tell you this much. I guess, you know, variety is the flavor of life, right? So you got different folks out there. So that just means all you got to do is travel a little bit. And, you know, you can meet some new people, meet some new ways of looking at things. And you're going to meet some assholes. But, you know, sometimes you're going to meet some really cool folks. So I'm good with it.
Well, if I come over there, the main thing I want to meet is a squirrel.
Okay.
Well, it's not if, this is when. Okay, because I do plan to come over 2021 over to the States for a couple of signings. So squirrels are top of my list.
All right.
I know that, and raccoon. God, I'd like to meet one of those little bastards too. They look like fun.
Well, we can definitely go to the parks around here. There is squirrels galore. They is all over the fucking place. You will not have a hard time encountering one of those. They're not gonna let you pet them. You know, they some of the
what
more.
What if I have my nuts?
Huh?
What if I have my nuts?
I mean, if you some of the more tame ones, you can actually throw bread to, just like the fucking ducks, and they will take it. But they're not going to come up and let you just like pet them. No, they're a little feral in that sense.
Well, I'm going to have to talk to our listeners. There's going to be somebody with a trained squirrel somewhere along the line.
Oh yeah, people got them as pets, so I mean, it can be done. Yeah, if you really want it that bad, we'll make it happen.
Oh, I do, and. See, right after squirrels and raccoons is snow. So
I'm not familiar with that one either. It don't snow down here where I'm at either. So guess what? I'm a snow virgin myself for the most part. I don't know.
I have to go up north and then travel down south. You see?
Yeah, you have to start up north. You start up north, you'll get your snow. If you start down here, you're going to be disappointed. It don't snow down here. I think I have seen snow twice in my entire life. It snowed on a Christmas down here in New Orleans one time, which was really fucking awesome. But that's about it.
You all think it was like Armageddon or something?
Oh, yeah, it is. When it snows down here, people, we don't know how to fucking drive in the snow. We have no idea. When it snows in New Orleans, we shut the roads down and shit. That is, I'm not even joking, that is the truth.
If it started to snow where I live, people would think it was just the end of the world. This coronavirus wouldn't be the issue. It would be, what the fuck is that shit falling from the sky?
What is it doing now?
What is it? Because it's a hot climate where I am. So, you know, even in the deep winter time for me, it's still shorts and a singlet. So
what's the minimum? Like, how cold does it get at its coldest where you are?
Probably hits around about 5 Celsius.
Oh, for God's sake, you're on Celsius. Oh, put that in Fahrenheit, please. Oh, I knew that was coming when I asked. I was like, are they freaking metric? Are they goddamn imperial? I fucking couldn't remember.
Celsius to Fahrenheit. Rightio, let's go with this. I've got it up. Come on, computer. Come on. All right, so let's say if I'm going, like, we get down to 5, it's 41 Fahrenheit.
All right. So that's, y'all is about the same, y'all got about the same climate in that sense than we do. 40 degrees is a cold winter in New Orleans. It will dip occasionally, like, to freezing, which is 32 for us. But that's like the exception, not the rule. So, yeah.
Yeah, so, we can get down to 0 or 1, but it'd be 1-2 days maximum, if that. But generally, it's around the 5 mark on a winter's night. And, of course, in our summer hot heat days, you're up at around 108.
We don't get that hot. Holy shit, man. But we got a lot of humidity.
We get humidity. I live on the coast. It's shit.
But we don't quite get over 100. So you got us beat on that.
We're tough people, I tell you.
We hang around in the 90s. You know, we'll be like 95, shit like that. But you'll feel like you're walking in a sauna. Like, the fucking humidity will be so intense. You'll feel like you just walked right on into a sauna. Like, you'll be soaking wet the minute you, like, walk outside.
Or you get in the shower and you walk out the shower and you feel like you're still in the shower.
Oh, absolutely.
It's terrible. Yeah. All right. So let's round this up with my new favorite game.
Oh, hell yeah.
What is it?
Search or dare. That is right. Hope you got something good.
Who's gonna go first?
I don't know. I don't know. Do you want to go first or do I want to go first?
I've got a word for you.
All right. Well, let's. All right. I guess I will go first, folks. For those of you who do not know, search or dare is played by giving each other a word to search in the Twitter search bar, and we have to read the first tweet that pops up under the latest tab from that word. So give it to me.
Okay. What do I do? How bad do I go, listeners? And there's my,
I think,
dog.
The dogs have spoken. They say fucking go all out, man.
Okay, let's go swallows.
Swallows with the S at the end?
Yeah, I like the S. S is good.
Swallows. Here we go.
Let's bird related.
Well, the first one appears to be, if you're looking at this with me, the first one appears to be written in Japanese or something, so I'm going to have to skip that.
Oh, yeah, no, I can't read that one either.
Let's see. Wow. Here's a good one. Here's a good one. If we scroll down together. Well, here's one from Mary Goring. I see if you're looking at the same one as I am.
Yeah.
This one is about cooking rabbits, I guess. It says here, Mary Goring says, if you roast a rabbit so that you can chew it well enough to be able to swallow it and not give yourself astounding indigestion, you go right ahead and enjoy it. Smiley face, smiley face, smiley face. And that came from a question from D. Robert Digman, who asked, would it be bad if I roasted a bunny rabbit for Easter Sunday dinner? So that kind of puts it in context. She wrote back and gave that a serious answer. Like, yeah, if you cook that motherfucker right, that little sumbitch gonna be just perfect.
Oh, that, can I cook a bunny for Easter? Well, if you cook it right, yes, of course. Well, she's got the Mary Goring approval. So that's got to be worth something.
All I'll get better day with long.
That's odd. I'm not very good at this. All right. Hit me with the word, Caleb.
All right. Let me think of a good one. And let's see here. Oh, here we go. Okay. Let's look up.
Okay.
Oh, here we go. I want you to type in BB.
You make me nervous when you do this. I swear to God.
That's the way the game is played. Type in BBW space. BB?
As yep. in?
As in letter B, letter B, letter W.
BBW, right?
Space, space, feet. Oh, boy, here we go.
It keeps on changing it to BBQ.
No, just... no, we ain't barbecuing nothing around here.
BBW feet. Oh, I'm not sure. I want to know what this is going to bring me. Oh, you know, I don't like feet. Do you know that?
What?
I really don't like feet.
But these people do.
Okay, so first one goes BBW goddess. Come and worship on this holy Sunday and be sinful the only way you know how to and enjoy licking my divine feet.
I love the fact that worked in fucking Easter with it. Like, hey, what are you doing on Holy Sunday? Come lick these feet. Oh, good job.
She's even good got job. Pretty painted toenails, though. She's painted them for Easter. It's pretty.
Oh, yeah, it's... she does have pastel toenails. Oh, let's take a look at BBW Goddess. Good job, BBW Goddess. I appreciate the marketing. She is so just like,
worship,
it's Easter.
On your holy Sunday, lick my divine feet.
Just prefer, just pretend that my toes are peeps and get them in your mouth. All right, so listen up, folks. If you're into feet out there, if there's any bookers that happen to also be footers, go look at Miss Goddess T. That's T with two E's. And she's apparently got an Easter dinner laid out for you with all 10 toes of the fixings right there, ladies and gentlemen. Happy Easter.
No, okay. No, no, no. Look, pull that picture up, Caleb. Pull that picture up, right?
You pulled the it picture up? Of her foot?
Yeah, pull it up and look between okay. the pink toe. I'm going to go. Oh, that's it.
Oh, man. She has some of that secret seasoning in there. She's like, the good stuff's in between my toes. I think that's like from new socks. You ever worn like a brand new pair of socks and you get like the dye and the fuzz and everything? I think that's what that looks like.
Oh, if I had to guess. I'm really pleased I'm doing this before my dinner. I tell you, oh, lordy, lordy, lordy. Oh, that's gross. I wish I hadn't seen that little extra bit there. That little extra something special. That just
you really looked in there deep, too. Oh, she's from England too. The one time David ain't here, man, we could have been like, what's going on with your people over there, David?
Explain. Oh God.
He's probably a member for OnlyFans. Apparently if you're into the OnlyFans.com thing, you can also check out the BBW Goddess over that way.
Totally incriminate him as much as we want. This is his punishment for being MIA. This is what happens when you don't turn up to a podcast. You get roasted. That's the way it works.
Hey, maybe she'll come on the show. Maybe we can have BBW Goddess as a guest coming up one of these nights. You know, it's like that. That would be an interesting fucking conversation right there. Just like, tell us all about the world of foot worship.
There's your challenge for the week, Caleb. Let's get her on the show because I am intrigued.
We can reach out if you're serious.
Oh,
you gotta let me know if you're 100% serious before I reach out to her, because you know.
Oh, I'm serious. Let's go. Why the fuck?
Let's do it. I am down for that. That would be a fun fucking interview. Be like, no, we don't have a writer on tonight. We have a walker. She's gonna walk all over your ass. All right, folks. If anybody out there is friends with the BBW Goddess, let her know. We're trying to get in touch, and we shall reach out.
BB wants to go with BBW.
I'm gonna. I think you should reach out to her because I think if me or David do, huh?
It might be better coming from you.
I mean, she's gonna think I'm just trying to like get at them feet. She's just gonna be like, "Here's another thirsty motherfucker trying to get at these damn feetsies."
And do you think that she's
We're going to find out, because I'm going to contact her and see, you know, what we can do. We're going to try and work this one out.
All right. Well, that is something to look forward to, listeners. Oh, look, this is what was our game called? Search and Dare.
Search and
Dare. I could find a better word. All right. So I think we've ended this podcast quite well on a very tasteful note.
A very tasty note. Tastes like that stuff between them toes.
All right. Well, thank you, Caleb, for joining me this Sunday.
Always, always a pleasure.
Where can we find you? Tell the listeners where they can find you.
Oh, man. Just look for me at BanningK1979. That is BanningK1979 on Twitter. Hit me up, everybody.
With your feet photos. Oh, God. All right.
Fine. Send all feet pictures to Centra.
No, I will make them a nice change from a dick pic. But still, no. Find me at Centra Sullivan. On anything, I'm always there. It's just I have a weird name. It's unique. So type it in. You'll find me wherever I am. And our Missing in Action co-host David Atherton Cooper, of course, at Kung Fu Ponda. Make sure you check him out as well. Send him a message and go, why the hell were you there, David? It better be important. Other than that, of course, our Twitter page at WTB Podcast, email or pod@gmail.com. Check us out. Feedback is always a wonderful thing. We love to hear what you think about what we say. We love to hear what ideas you have for us and where you want us to go. Most times we'll go wherever we need to go, won't we, Caleb?
And we are willing to dip into the foot fetish world. I think there's no limit.
That is very true. We have blurred the lines of limits. Excellent. Okay, bookers, we will see you next week for episode 10, our double digit. We need to plan something big and have a cake, Caleb, I do believe.
Indeed, indeed.
All right. I'll see you next week, Caleb.
All right.
Bye, bookers.
Good night.